Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight's topic is part two of the JonBenet Ramsey case. I'm Kim Colton, Director of Research for CrimeWire, and I'll be manning the switchboard and monitoring the chat room. And now let me introduce the host of tonight's show, statement analyst and CrimeWire consultant, Peter Hyatt. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. It's a little chilly where I'm at here. It's about 25 below zero, but we're staying warm, so that's the important thing.
25 below zero Fahrenheit?
It's about 15 below, but with the wind chill, it's about 25.
Wow, I thought it was cold here. We're about zero. So I guess between the two of us, we're pretty cold.
We're pretty cold, but tomorrow's a red letter day. It's going to be in the teens, so we're going to have a heat wave.
Oh, there you go. Well, I thought Maine was cold. Wow, that's a lot colder.
So tonight, go ahead. I'll let you start.
Well, regarding the our part two of the JonBenet Ramsey case, what I wanted to talk about tonight was some of the general indicators of child sexual abuse for our listeners. And these are things that teachers, social workers, nurses, parents, others can recognize as possible indicators and then make the jump from these, they're just commonly called indicators, to specific linguistic indicators and how it is that we might be able to come to a conclusion of a matter in terms of analysis of a case. So I thought we'd begin with just some general indicators that parents, teachers, social workers, just concerned citizens can keep an eye out for, mm-hmm. and then we'll move on to the linguistic ones.
Okay.
And then I will go back to the JonBenet Ramsey case, starting with the 911 call. I believe we're going to be able to play it for listeners.
Yes, hopefully it will. Hopefully we will.
Okay. Now, when we come to a list like this, it's very important for everyone to remember that in life itself, in dealing with sexually abused children, the signs are variable. We never hang our hat on one sign. We never say, well, the child is doing such and such, so therefore the child must be sexually abused. It's not that case at all. It's a situation where we want to be on the alert for it. We want to make sure that it didn't happen. So, mm-hmm. for instance, and this is kind of a common one with school teachers, is little Johnny is known to be a kind of a dirty little man, like most boys are. They like to play in dirt and get dirty and sweaty and grimy and carry rocks in their pockets, like normal little boy,
mm-hmm.
and Johnny has to be told to take a bath or jump in the shower or wash behind his ears, and we've all seen that in Hollywood and growing up, and mom is reminding him, wash behind those ears from the little rascals, that sort of thing.
Right.
Well, let's say in school, little Johnny, one day the teacher notices that he runs to the bathroom and he comes back with his hands washed, and an hour later he runs back to the bathroom, he washes his hands again, and he washes his hands again. He's repeatedly washing his hands, and the teacher is concerned that there's something wrong. And it may be innocuous, maybe nothing. Maybe that someone told him he better wash his hands more often, but the wise teacher, social worker, nurse, anyone involved with children might recognize that children that are sexually abused will sometimes become obsessed with water. That obsession could be where they're Yeah, where they're constantly washing their hands, taking showers, or the very opposite, where they won't go near the water, mimicking a depressed adult, where will not bathe, will not go near water. But what the common denominator of that is water. Another
why
indicator,
is that?
I think personally, and I don't know, but I think it has something to do with the desire to clean off the guilt or the film.
Right.
And children do feel guilt, even as their victims. I don't know if you remember, but years ago, social workers used to teach, and also was taught in schools, almost like a fad, good touch, bad touch, where the child would learn what's a good touch and what's a bad touch. The problem with that was that when the child is molested, the child isn't always injured. And so this is why it didn't always feel pain. The child didn't necessarily
bad.
Feel pain when the, it was confusing to kids. We've seen pedophiles like Michael Jackson, for instance, who verbally indicated that not only did he sexually molest the boys in question, but he actually indicated that he had victims all over the world, South America, in the Middle East, to name two places specifically that he mentioned. So there is a desire to wash either the filth of what has happened away or the guilt. We know that little children, like in the good touch, bad touch, where the child wasn't injured, the child still felt guilty. And so this is, and many victims do talk about feeling guilt. Those that froze, for instance, might even later blame themselves, even at an early age. But there are these types of signs that people should look for. And here's a kind of a controversial one, and it really shouldn't be, is bedwetting. Bedwetting can happen to anyone. Any child can go to bed at any given time, and it can mean nothing but the child was too tired to get up to go to the bed, or the child had an accident. However, it is also something that children do who are sexually molested. So we wouldn't want a parent to hear this to say, you know, oh no, my child wet his bed, wet her bed, perhaps the child was sexually molested. No, it's just a small indicator to be aware, because children that are sexually molested, 10, even 12 years of age, are continually incontinent in their beds when there's no real logical reason for them to be that way. There's no medical reason, I should say. There's perhaps a logical reason. So bedwetting could happen to a child, and it could be a medical problem, or it could be a behavioral issue, or it could be an indicator of sexual molestation. Children that become obsessed suddenly with their private parts. Children that become obsessed with urine or feces. I remember a case where a little boy was literally bagging his feces at home, sneaking it to school, and literally playing with it at school. He had been sexually molested, and there becomes this almost an obsession where not only do they wet themselves, but they also sometimes just become obsessed with their own urine and feces. There are, and again, these are just possible physical and behavioral indicators. Child wakes up in the middle of the night sweating, screaming, or shaking with a nightmare. It could be that they had a bad dream about a tiger they saw on a Disney movie, or it could be something worse. The children that get involved with sexual play, masturbation, that sort of thing. Showing aggression towards pets. I've seen this before where a child who appeared one day to be a loving, gentle child later became, in a very short period of time, a very aggressive with pets child. A child, I had one that was trying to kill a puppy. Maybe 3 or 4 years of age, trying to kill a puppy who, you know, 6 months earlier had not tried that. Children that actually put their fingers inside the private parts of animals or trying to stick their finger up at the anus of a dog. I've seen that where a sexually molested boy had done that. General violence where a child has tried to kill another child is usually an indication of sexual abuse. There's, of course, the for especially for young girls, there'll be urinary tract infections where they experience that in an inordinate amount of times. They may show fear of certain places. They may have appetite issues where there's a changing. They may certain types of food may trigger them off. We've even seen certain types of games, those foods where a young child is offered an ice cream cone and the child just freaks out because the ice cream cone was something that the perpetrator used.
Described
his sex organ as an ice cream cone. One little girl, too young to play Monopoly, was freaked out when the word Monopoly came up because that was the name that the molester had given his sex games with her.
So we
sometimes see that, sure. They may act out with dolls. They may pick up dolls and show sexually acting out. And again, this could be something they saw on television. They could have walked in and seen mommy and daddy, or it could be a sign that they have been molested.
I guess it would take a trained professional to determine if it was something that actually happened. I mean, when you're talking about the dolls, or if they did see something on TV, or
parents can and should speak to their children when they see some of these behaviors. And they almost can do it without even speaking to the kids in one sense, because one of the things that I always ask parents is, what's changed in the last 6 months? Give me the names of everyone who had access to your children. And has anyone slept over the house the last couple of months? Has anyone come visiting new? And what I had alluded to vaguely this morning when we posted on Facebook was a school teacher had called me and said, you know, I want to report Uncle John. And I said to her, what do you want to report? She said, I was had to go to the little boy's apartment to deliver his homework. He's been out sick. And Uncle John was there. And I said, well, what do you want to report about him? And she said, I don't know. He just creeps me out. And sure enough, she was in the presence of a child molester who was not the boy's uncle. It was someone who had been staying overnight. Just that teacher instinct is, teachers are so closely associated, I think, with maternal instincts and protective capacities over children that they seem to have a strong sense about when a child's in danger. And so although she had nothing really to report, she was reporting an inflamed instinct on her part. And a little bit of research showed that the fellow that was there, he wasn't an uncle, he was a child molester, a registered sex offender. Change in, just a general change in appearance, a loss of appetite or an increase of crazy appetite. One little girl who every winter would go into rages and then be fine most of the year. Then the winter would come and she had been molested in the winter at a very, very young age where I believe the body remembers even though the brain can't articulate that. It's such a crime against nature itself, such a crime against the image of the creator that the body just is repulsed by it, and people can claim genetic sexual attraction all they want. It is this vile desire to destroy evil for selfish exploitation. Mm-hmm. Our society recognizes that children are to be protected from sexuality. You know, in the same breath, we're inundating them with sex and TV and sex and movies and that sort of thing. But we all become upset when a school teacher, a male school teacher, for instance, molests a young teenage girl because we recognize that he used the discrepancy in sophistication to gratify himself. He used a position of authority, for instance. He tells her to sit, she sits. He tells her to stand up, she stands up. He tells her to do her homework, she doesn't do her homework. He gives her a command sexually, she does that. It's a natural type of authority that he's exploiting. We see this, Kim, with mentally retarded adults.
Wow.
They are in every state in the union X amount of times more likely to experience sexual exploitation and sexual molestation and sexual assault than everybody in the population. And every state that has statistics on this, they are off the charts. I can't quote statistics. It's just that bad everywhere. There are those with adult mental retardation or adult autism that can't speak for themselves, and so they become open prey. And I posted a story this week on the blog where a man with developmental disabilities was sexually exploited by a worker who had been grooming him, who had been preparing him. I've seen men prepare ice pops with vodka and put them in the refrigerator and hand them to little girls who come to this. Yeah, there's so many of those little things that go on that parents need to be able to speak to their children and to look for these signs and to find out that something is going on in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we cross over to statement analysis, what
the
we
linguistic
find,
indicators, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, we find that the things that we were concerned about, say visually, have the same types of concerns that we have linguistically. And it's fascinating, but it's regrettably fascinating. For instance, when a child talks about going to bed, I'll always ask a child, where do you sleep? Tell me about when you go to bed. If we have two children talking about it, one will say, I went to bed and went to sleep. And the other child might say, I closed the door and I pulled the covers up and I went to sleep. Using additional language, we notice two things there. We notice that that child mentioned a door opening or closing, and he mentioned covers. Now, most of us, especially you and me where we live, are going to sleep under the blankets. It's pretty cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most people won't mention that little tidbit. They'll just say, I went to bed at 9 o'clock and I went to bed at 10 o'clock and went to sleep, that sort of thing. Some will say, I went to bed at 9 o'clock, I pulled up the covers, and I went to sleep. That expression of shows a need to cover oneself is something we would want to explore for possible sexual abuse. We find that adults, for instance, that were sexually abused in childhood will mention things like doors opening and closing, even when it's not necessary. If someone says, you open the door, yes, I open the door, that's not an indication of anything. But when someone can say, I went into a certain room, but they need to tell you that they opened the door first, it's just something that we keep in mind. Another really simple one, and this
very is, interesting,
is if I were to ask you, and I won't because it'd be embarrassing, but ask somebody, tell me about you when you were growing up. And you might say, well, you know, my earliest memory was when I was 5, I was a little girl, and I went with my dad to Easter Sunday church service, something like that. I had a beautiful dress on. Someone else might say, when I was a kid, I played Little League, and I just loved it. It was wonderful. And that first person referred to herself as a little girl. The second person referred to himself as a kid. When someone refers to themselves as a child, it is a very high likelihood that they experienced child abuse growing up, 80% likely of that abuse to be related to sexual abuse.
So as a child, you mean as a very young child?
Yeah, if you were talking about when you were growing up, and this has never failed me once in all the interviews that I've done about this, is someone might talk about themselves, oh yeah, when I was growing up, when I was a child, and I may say...
I just want to differentiate between the person who said I played soccer and the other one who said I was a little girl and I had a pretty dress on, I went to church or whatever. What do you mean by young child?
Well, how you refer to yourself while you were at that age of childhood.
Oh, okay.
You might say girl, I might say boy, kid, little guy, little fella. But when someone uses the word child, and it's not rocket science, it's not difficult to understand why, we don't generally say, oh, look at that, he's a kid molester. He's a boy molester. We say he's a child molester. And so the word child is often associated with child molestation. And what has been found in the research is that that reference that someone uses of themselves is 80% likely to be linked to explicit sexual abuse. So it, it does come out of the language. Yeah.
Yes, yes. I see that, so yeah.
You might see, for instance, two women who were abused as children, for instance, and they both had little girls. One may react by hypersexualizing her child. The other may go the other extreme and try to neuter her child and try to make her completely gender neutral. They're both extreme, but they're both telling us that something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
In the as we look at these things, we just simply listen to the language, and like the indicators of sexual abuse, we do not hang our hat on just a single indication.
Mm-hmm.
We will not say, Johnny was sexually abused because he was what is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
We might say, Johnny wets his bed. Johnny has aggression towards little pets. Johnny has an obsession with washing. We really need to talk to his parents and find out what's going on in his home. We need to find out who has been visiting him, who has had access to him, has he stayed overnight someplace, that sort of thing. I know the pat answer is to say, well, you know, call in the experts. But parents must be very careful in doing that. We live in a world today that we believe that anything associated with government must be right. We've been conditioned to believe that government is always right. I saw today in the news they were talking about postal workers, how someone who their only skill is to have a high school diploma and drop a letter in a mailbox makes on average $53,000 a year. And I thought, wow, if you put that same person with that same skill in the private sector, they'd have a tough time getting past minimum wage. And so we have this almost like a hyper-respect of all things that are our government, and people believe, well, you know, if the state says so or the federal government says so, it really must be, when that simply isn't the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this because a lot of people can call child abuse hotlines and crisis intervention, for instance, and believe that the people coming to their door are going to be experts. It's not always the case.
Oh, right.
And so I, especially with children, I think that parents must be very, very careful on who they trust. They should get to know their doctor well. They should get to know their coaches well. They should keep a sharp eye on everything. But just to pick up the phone and say, yeah, I'm going to call the crisis hotline and have people have access to my child. Crazy. In my
right.
mind, in my world, that's crazy. Because you don't know who's coming. You don't know what's their personal beliefs.
I just want to interject here. When my daughter was young in grade school, and they would take these bus trips, and I would drop her off and see her on the bus, and they would go to the museum or, you know, whatever. And I always had this dying need to check the bus driver's alcohol level, like a breathalyzer. You know, I mean, I was just crazy about that. You know, I just, Lord.
But
anyway.
It may sound crazy, but that one time where someone was drinking or something nefarious, we've gotten to a point, I think, in society where no one is responsible for anything any longer. And
right.
It's just spilled over to everywhere.
Not personally responsible.
There's been a lifting of, I think, certain types of constraints on this type of behavior, along with the sexualization. Where I live, JCPenney was selling thongs for girls, pre-teenage girls, little girls, thongs.
No way.
JCPenney was, until they received enough letters, at least in my area, where they stopped. So we live in that now society. But if you turn the clock back to 1996, 1997, when JonBenet Ramsey was murdered, most people, at least most people that I spoke to, and still to this day, I think, were shocked by her sexualized appearance. there was shock bias.
Yes.
But before I jump ahead, let me finish the linguistics. So we have doors.
Okay.
Opening, closing. We have references to water. Just washing. A good example of that, I think, is the sexual homicide case that we viewed, Amanda Knox, Foxy Knoxy, where her references to water were silly. They were off the charts, but she was witness to and participated in a sexual homicide. So we found that her going to that language was natural. So doors, windows, coverings, water, these are the type of things that we hear linguistically that may indicate, and a reference to someone as a child, may indicate child abuse. Now, I said on an earlier show, I've said this in the past, that it's impossible for a father to sexually molest his own daughter. And I qualified that by saying, in his mind, he has to change her from his daughter to someone else, to a girl, to a thing. He has to depersonalize her. And this, what I mean is, impossible for a father to molest his daughter linguistically. I mean this from a linguistic point of view. I'm not talking about reality. I'm talking about verbalized reality. So we had an example that we used where a man said his daughter was crying, his wife had left, the girl went and did her homework, and when his wife came back, his daughter was making accusations. And what had happened was, in his language, when his wife was home, he talked about his daughter. When the wife wasn't home, he changed her to the girl. That's where the molestation had taken place. When the wife came back, he called her daughter again. While the wife, and literally what this guy was doing, was blaming his wife for leaving. If you hadn't left, I wouldn't have molested her. That type of thing. In his language, he can call her daughter sometimes and sometimes not. So what we look at in the JonBenet Ramsey case, were there any linguistic indicators of sexual abuse in either the language of John and or Patsy, in how they speak about themselves, and how they spoke about JonBenet? Mm-hmm. And having said that, I have to add that most people who were sexually abused in childhood do not go on to sexually abuse others. Basically, everyone who does perpetrate sexual abuse talks about being abused as a child. So we may say a very low percentage of people that are sexually abused go on to offend themselves, but basically 100% or close to it, that sort of thing, 100% of those who do sexually molest children talk about being exposed or sexually abused in some way in childhood, whether it was an early exposure to a sexualized environment like pornography or inappropriate dressing or out-and-out sexual abuse. They had some bizarre experience where we know that someone that becomes sexually aroused over a child is not normal. It's not. It's just not the norm. Something has to happen to cause that type of bizarre thing to go on. We have gotten away from punishment of these things, and so the emboldenedness is going on as people try to understand it. This is not a call to excuse that behavior. I know that with Casey Anthony and George Anthony and some of the allegations there, people were very upset because what they didn't want to hear was, oh, it was okay for Casey Anthony to kill her child because she had been sexually molested. And that is not okay.
No.
And yeah.
No.
However, understanding what goes into making a monster should stand as a warning to all of us that are parents to be careful with what our children's eyes see, to be careful who we expose them to whom we trust our children, get to know your children's teachers. Yeah, follow the bus driver. Give them a breathalyzer. I like that. It's a scary world.
Oh, yeah. It
is. But listen, if you listen carefully to the language that a child uses, and that itself can be an indicator. So having said all that, let's then move on to the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Yes.
If we start at the beginning, many of us have the image of a six-year-old girl with heavy makeup on, with bleached hair, with a sexy outfit that you'd have to look, take a second look to realize, no, this is not a young woman. This is a child.
She almost looked like a Vegas showgirl in some of those pics.
Right. That was the most common description in the late 90s was Las Vegas showgirl.
Mm-hmm.
And a Las Vegas showgirl is meant to be a sexual imagery. In other words, the clothing
arousal.
Is designed to elicit a sexual response or a sexual arousal. That's the purpose. This is what sexy clothing means. It means it's designed in whatever way to elicit a sexual response. When I saw that first picture, late December, shortly after Christmas, 1996, I think it was, I was shocked that any parent would dress up their little girl that way. It was just shocking. It was just a shock to the senses. That shock did wear off as months and months passed and we saw more of the pictures. And, of course, the Ramses then encountered with, yeah, but that's not how she looked all the time. It was just really a grotesque type of thing to think that any parent would deliberately do that to their child. So we start with that imagery, and then we have the fact that these were people of wealth. Let's start with a 911 call and listen carefully to the language. We won't hang our hat on any one thing, but we will be careful to think of what is the expected. You allegedly wake up, or at least want people to think you wake up, and you find a note saying your daughter has been kidnapped. You run to her room, and you find she's not there. You pick up the phone, and you call 911. We ask you, whoever you is that I'm speaking to ask yourself, what would you say? And most people, I think, would say, my daughter is missing. This has been the number one answer that I've heard from people over the years, that they would say is, my daughter is missing. They wouldn't jump to any conclusions just yet. Now, in defense of the Ramses, which people do, is people love to say, you don't know how you'd react under that situation. No one knows. That's not true. Or the famous Cindy Anthony quote, there's no book on grieving.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
there is
I
a book
agree.
On grieving. There's a book on how people react with 911 calls, for instance. In a 911 call from a biological parent, this is what we look for. First person singular, possessive pronouns. We look for the caller to specifically ask for help for the victim. For the victim. It's very important to differentiate. What happens is people spit out their words quickly. Legally, it's called excited utterance, but when they're spitting out their words quickly, we're listening to see, does something sound rehearsed or staged, or is this just the pouring out of a heart instantly? And when we deal with a mother, we have maternal instincts that go back to our Solomon example, where a mother's maternal instincts are so inflamed that you'd have a better chance of messing with an angry bear over her whelps being taken than you would a mother whose child has been taken. It's that powerful and that strong. When Casey Anthony said that she hadn't reported her child missing for 31 days, the operator was shocked because that wasn't what she was expecting. She was expecting, so she said, well, why did you wait? And Casey said, I went through other resources, and obviously she was simply stalling because she wanted her daughter's body to rot away as she committed murder. Well, that's called the expected. The expected is, my daughter's missing, you've got to find her. You want to hear a mother speak. This is very personal. This is very up close. In the case of baby Ayla here in Maine, the grandmother said that it's really hard when you're waiting for a phone call from the police about your granddaughter. She didn't say it's hard because I'm waiting for a call for my granddaughter. She said it's hard to think that your house was being cased. She didn't say, it's hard to think my house would be in chaos. People don't like to lie, so they avoid it. But they do want to persuade and make it sound a certain way. We don't interpret them. We listen. Now, how about this? An objection. You're saying that you don't interpret, yet you're saying that water, doors, windows are possible indicators of sexual abuse. Isn't that interpretation?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no. What we're saying is if someone says, I opened the door, we don't reinterpret that. We believe that they opened the door. We believe them. What we're asking is, why do they have the need to tell us that they opened the door before they went in?
Right.
So we're not reinterpreting language. We are listening carefully. So I'd like you to play this. Go ahead, I'm sorry, Ken.
Oh, no, I'm just going to say that I would never say I opened the door. I would just say I went in.
Sure, most people do. I went into the room. Picture this, and I want you to think of the baby Ayla grandmother when she said, you're waiting for a call from the police about your granddaughter. She doesn't want to say, hey, I know the baby's dead. I'm the grandmother, and I know it was an accident, and people are going to blame my son, so he had to do this. She's going to want to deceive, but she doesn't want to lie because it causes internal stress.
Mm-hmm.
So what she said wasn't technically a lie. It is deceptive, but it wasn't technically a lie. You're waiting.
True.
Sure. Yeah. A grandmother should be very personal. A mother even more. This is why when we listen to certain mothers, Billie Jean Dunn, the mother of Haley Dunn, always uses distancing language. Yeah, always distancing language. Never that up close and personal because she obviously knew that Haley was dead from the beginning. We saw this with other mothers. We saw this even with Misty Croslin's stepmother or step-babysitter or whatever you want to call her, of Haley Cummings from Florida a couple of years back. Distancing language, we heard off the charts distancing language in Deborah Bradley, Baby Lisa, where she had just so much trouble. She couldn't even use Lisa's name, and she had trouble with the pronouns, and she stumbled. Well, John Ramsey, in spite of being coached by some really high-priced $500-$700 an hour lawyers, still gave us indicators in his language of sexual abuse. So let's start with that 911 call.
Okay, here we go.
What's going on there, ma'am?
We have a kidnapping. Hurry, please.
Explain to me what's going on, okay?
There's a note left and our daughter's gone.
A note was left and your daughter is gone? How old is your daughter?
6 years old. She's gone. 6 years old.
How long ago was it?
I don't know. I just found the note. And my daughter's gone.
Does it say who took her?
What?
Does it say who took her?
I don't know. There's a ransom note here.
It's a ransom note?
It says FBTC. Victory. Please.
Okay, what's your name? Are you
Kathy Ramsey? I'm the mother. Oh, my God. Please.
I'm sending an officer over, okay?
Please.
Do you know how long she's been gone?
No, I don't. Please, we just got up and she ran here. Oh, my God, please.
Okay,
please,
girl.
Please, somebody.
I am, honey.
Please.
Take a deep breath.
Please,
me, okay?
hurry.
Kathy. Kathy.
Okay. What we do in analysis. Was there more?
I'm sorry. We just had to wait for the. Okay, there we go. Okay, there we go.
Thank you for getting that up.
Go ahead.
We do in statement analysis is that we remove that emotion that you heard, that clear emotion in her voice. We remove it and we study just the words. This is what we say. The subject or the person is dead. The statement, the words they use, is alive to us. So people like to debate whether something sounds genuine or not. And I know that Sergio Chelis, for instance, when he giggled on his 911 call, it's impossible to ignore that.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But what I ask listeners to do is to ignore
the tone, the inflection of the tears, because she, I grew up with seven sisters. I fall to pieces when a woman cries. I know that women can cry for a variety of reasons, just like men can. But I can't discern whether those tears are tears of deception or not. I cannot. Because, let's say that JonBenet was really kidnapped, so her crying is because her daughter's kidnapped. Let's say that JonBenet died by accident that night and there's a cover-up. Those tears are real because she is really scared that she's going to be arrested or lose custody of Burke. So whatever it may be, those tears can be real, whether there's deception or not. So we ask everyone, put that away now. Just what you're impacted emotionally, put away and listen to the words that she used. Listeners may have noticed that she did not ask for help for JonBenet. One of the first things that Dr. Susan Adams, the former FBI, she studied under LSI, Laboratory for Scientific Interrogation, Abinoam Sapir. She studied under Mr. Sapir, and readers now know I had a very exciting announcement about this week, is that Mr. Sapir has written a scientific content analysis, a scan document on the book of Genesis, of all things, which is going to be released shortly in Hebrew, and then months down the road will be an English version. So it's a very exciting announcement. Dr. Adams studied under Mr. Sapir. Abinoam Sapir is a rare genius, and he is the grandfather of all analysis that's done in our country and in other countries around the world today. Cops everywhere that have studied and investigators everywhere that have studied owe him a debt of gratitude. Well, Dr. Adams is no different. She did a really good job. I'm sorry, I forget the co-author of the study. She co-authored a study on 911 calls of domestic homicides, and she was able to use the basic principles of statement analysis along with the data of domestic homicide 911 calls to make a checklist for police on whether the caller has guilty knowledge of the child's death or not.
Oh, my gosh. How cool is that?
Yeah. Some of them are very simple and very common sense type of things. One of the things that they say, does the caller begin with a greeting? Hello. Hi. How are you? How's the weather? That kind of casual call is very unexpected. We saw that with the little girl, the Australian father. Who was that?
McCain?
No, the Australian, the little girl who was dismembered by her stepmother. Her father was from Australia.
Zombie. Oh, no.
Yep.
Oh.
Where the
who
is called
who?
Guilty knowledge. Zara Baker, little girl.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But it began with a greeting. Tiffany Hartley, David
oh,
Hartley, she began
God.
With a hello, that sort of thing. So we looked for a greeting. We asked this, does the caller specifically ask for help for the victim? What the study found was that in innocent callers, the person is so zoned on the victim that they ask for help specifically for the victim. Guilty callers would ask for help in general, or sometimes they even ask for help for themselves. We asked, does the caller use the words, I'm sorry, anywhere? For any reason, Casey Anthony, I'm sorry, she said during the call. That sneaks into the language as they have regretted what they've done, for instance. So I started off by saying that this is a very personal, upfront situation where a mother is calling. The expected is, my daughter is missing. Even my child, perhaps, referring to her as a child because of the risk and the frightness. Well, the 911 operator started off by saying, what is going on there, ma'am? It's a good question. She said, we have a kidnapping. Hurry, please. So she didn't say, my daughter is missing. She jumped to the conclusion of the matter already. That's concerning. It's a slight red flag that she's willing to accept that's kidnapping. Some say, well, there's a ransom note. She said she didn't read the whole thing, but just enough, and then she quoted the end of it. But the fact that she jumps to a kidnapping, that is concerning. But far more concerning is the pronoun we. She should have said, my daughter is missing. Instead, she avoids mentioning JonBenet at all and says, we have a kidnapping. Hurry, please. So that concerns me. Yeah, that concerns me. And the note itself, that we'll cover separately, but we're going to ask ourselves, does this sound rehearsed? Because the fact that she's using the conclusion of the matter, and she's avoiding the personal pronoun I. James Dillingham's work showed that guilty people, like every parent of every teenager knows, love to use the word we. We were all at the movies.
Yeah.
We were all, you know, everyone was doing that sort of thing. We love to share guilt. When it's in a word, I, when it's guilt, we. It is very unexpected that a mother of a missing child would use the word we. Very unexpected. If a father, if he's speaking on behalf of the mother, sometimes may do it. But when we go to the higher elevation of maternal instincts, for those of you that are egalitarian, they don't understand about men being from Mars and women being from Venus or vice versa. Women appear to have been created with a higher and greater emotional capacity than men. And with that emotional capacity is what we saw in Solomon's exploiting of that for the sake of truth. Women have fierce protective capacities towards their children, perhaps even greater than fathers. And so a mother will always say, my. She is not interested in sharing anything. It's my. So the fact that she didn't say, my daughter's missing, we now have two things within the first sentence that are concerning. Hurry, please. We're listening to see, will she ask for help for her daughter? So the 911 operator says then, in response, explain to me what is going on, okay? And she said, we have a, she was sounded like she was going to repeat the kidnapping line again. That sounds terribly rehearsed. Then she said, so we have a kidnapping, we have a, and stopped herself, self-censoring. Then she said, there's a note left. That's passive language, there's a note left. Passive language is like saying, my wife and I were wrestling and the gun went off. When someone uses passive language, they're attempting to conceal identity or responsibility. Instead of saying, they gave me a note, they left us a note has been left in a passive way, alerts us that she may be trying to conceal the identity of the written note's author, the ransom note's author. So
oh
we have
my
a
God.
Yep, we have a kidnapping. We have a, there's a rehearsed part. She repeats it. There's a note left, and my daughter is gone. Nope, she said, our daughter is gone. This is an interesting part of language, is taking possession of a child. That's the language of step-parenting. People that are step-parents will often say, our. When two biological parents are together, they say, mine. Even when they're standing close together, they often say, my. When a child, when there's a step-parent involved, or there's a foster parenting, or there's a marriage going wrong, that's when you'll hear someone will say, our, because they have a need to share.
You know, oh, that's so true, because I would say, my.
Sure.
My daughter. My daughter. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I had a,
okay.
A very intelligent investigator once said to me that her husband was going to come and visit me for a moment, and I have to sign some papers or something, and I want you to profile him. And I said, I'm not going to profile him. She, oh, yes, you're going to profile. No, I'm not going to profile him. So he came, very nice man. I signed the papers. He was gone. The phone rang. And she said, well, what was it? What can you tell me? And I said, he was a very nice man. There's nothing to tell you. You're a lucky woman. She said, no, you tell me something. Something his language told you. I said, okay. He said he had to leave, that he had to pick up our daughter. And she goes, yeah, that's right. He had to pick her up from daycare. I said, but he said, our daughter? She says, what did that tell you? I said, usually that means that there is something shared about the child, often the language of step parenting, that sort of thing. And she said, oh, she's adopted. So it's that adoption,
oh,
foster parenting, shared responsibility,
oh,
with someone else. We have,
right,
kind of a broad example there. When two biological parents are together, they will, even when standing together, will often say, my, unless the child has a really bad report card, then they'll say, her daughter, in that way. But generally we'll hear my at a biological parents. Now, John and Patsy,
uh-huh,
are biological parents of JonBenet, and as far as we know, there's no divorce plans that we knew of. But the thing is, this is an emergency of the highest order. There's nothing higher to a mother than a missing child. And the fact that she is sharing responsibility twice, in the first two lines she used the word we, and when she finally goes towards the daughter, she uses our, that is not a good sign of someone that is,
mm-hmm,
being honest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it continues. So remember, we don't hang our hat on just any one indicator. We're listening for everything. She said, our daughter is gone, so we have that missing. And the operator repeated back the passivity. A note was left and your daughter is gone? And Patsy said, yes. How old is your daughter? She is 6 years old. She is blonde. 6 years old. Now, through those tears,
mm-hmm,
what she said was, she is 6 years old. She is blonde. She is 6 years old. So 6 years,
mm-hmm,
old is repeated, but then she throws in the color of her hair. So rather than say that she has blonde hair, or we dyed it blonde, because she actually had, I think, brownish hair, Patsy brought in a physical description of her daughter. She called her a blonde. She didn't say she had blonde hair. She is blonde.
Oh,
and
wow.
We have a little girl that's dressed up like a Las Vegas showgirl.
Mm-hmm.
Very sexualized, and now she's been called a blonde instead of just a hair color. She didn't ask, first of all, the question is, how old is she? And this is why, again, it sounds...
Yeah, it pops out.
Object. She's 6 years old. She is blonde. 6 years old. So sandwiched in between the answer to the question, which is repeated twice about her age, is the fact that she's a blonde. Really bizarre language. I don't think that,
mm-hmm,
I would have... My daughter was 6 years old at the time that JonBenet went missing. She had dirty blonde hair. It since has turned brown. It was blondish brown then. I don't think I would have described her by her hair color. But I would have said she's a blonde.
No.
She's 6 years old.
No.
She's a little girl.
No, I would never have described her by her hair color.
But this is... And this is not only describing her by her hair color.
Oh.
This is during a 911 call.
Yeah.
It gives me insight into how she was viewed by her mother.
When you say that, it's like it's so disconnected. Patsy's comment about, and she's blonde, it's just so disconnected.
It is. And it kind of shows how she was viewed.
So
the operator said,
yeah,
how long ago was this? I don't know. Then she said, just found a note, and my daughter is missing. Just found a note, drops the pronoun. Instead of saying, I just found the note, she drops the pronoun I. People don't like to lie. If she wrote the note, which I think she did, and she left it there, which I think she did, she's not going to want to say, I just found the note. She won't want to lie directly, so she'll hedge her way away from it by dropping the pronoun I, just found a note. Now, she had already introduced that to us. A note was left. So it should now be the note.
I know. Exactly. I would have said, I just found a note, or I found a note,
after you've mentioned it, you will call it the note. We have an expression in statement analysis.
Yeah.
Pronouns don't lie. Articles don't lie. So if someone says, the man tried to rob me, I gave a man my money, you're likely looking at a scam, because it should be, a man tried to rob me, I gave the man money. When articles are confused, you're looking at deception.
Mm-hmm.
When pronouns are confused, you're looking at deception. They're not part of subjective language. They're instinctive to humans, to English-speaking humans. So not only do we have a missing pronoun, but we have the confused article. And again, then she changes to, my daughter is missing. This is interesting. We look at the change from our daughter to my daughter, and we ask, what in context is different about the first sentence and this sentence? What we find is the presence of the ransom note mentioned twice. Just found a note, and my daughter is missing. So now she's my daughter, as Patsy talks about the ransom note, which she says in a deceptive manner, instead of the note, it's a note. So the drop pronoun is quite significant. So we move on. Does it say who took her? And Patsy says, what? Does it say who took her? And she answers the question, no, but then adds on, I don't know. It's there. There is a ransom note here. So now we have another mention of the note, and it's now a ransom note, not the note, not the ransom note. Her articles are spilling out deception. Deception. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's there. It's there is passive as well. Then we move on. So we have more indicators of deception. It's a ransom note, the 911 operator says. She says, it says SBTC victory, please.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's your name? Are you? And she interrupts, says, Patsy Ramsey, I am the mother. Oh, my God, please. I'm sending it off to her over, okay? Please. Do you know how long she's been gone? No, I don't. Please. We just got up. Not I, but we just got up, and she's not here. Oh, my God, please. And this is a critical point where she was asked, do you know how long she's been gone? She answers no, but then gives us additional information with her words. No, I don't. No is the fine answer. We just got up is additional information. Mm-hmm. What is the purpose? Okay. Why do we need to know we just got up? This is what we call alibi building. She wants them to think that she was asleep. She never said she was asleep. And even in her book that she wrote, she didn't say she was asleep. In fact, she came downstairs in the same clothes that she wore the night before, a major mistake by a beauty queen that even her friends picked up on.
Yeah.
The 911 call is considered deceptive in statement analysis. There are indications of guilty caller in that very short, tearful call.
Why would they position her body that way? I mean, that just... Maybe that's a question for another show, because we got like a minute left. And
well,
so I just kind of want to wrap this up. But
the short answer to that, so readers don't hang on that, is that the literature and things that they had in their home had to do with crime stories. They wanted to make it look like a real crime had taken place, so that they would be believed this was staged.
That is so sad. Well, let's finish up here, Peter. Thank you so much again. Gosh, you're terrific. thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Denny and I will have well-known psychic Karen Storstein on. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. And Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kim. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.